Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is tax advisor Russell Fox. Russell was with us December 29th of last year. So if you like what you hear today, you might want to check out the archives and listen to the old show. We received plenty of kudos for having Russ on that show. Russell Fox, welcome back to Gambling with an Edge.
I'm glad to be back.
All right. Before we talk to Russ, we got a... you attended a seminar recently for travelers looking for an edge. How was that, and would you recommend that seminar in the future for our listeners?
You know, I thought it was really interesting. It was called the Frequent Travelers University. They have these around the country, around the world, actually, in different locations. And, you know, it's very much the same kind of stuff that a lot of Advantage players, particularly video poker players, do. Mostly it's about churning credit cards to earn airline miles and cash back and things like that. You know, there's not much money in it. Compared to, I think all the people that are going to these seminars, if they realized what they could do playing video poker, they would all switch from airline miles to playing video poker. But it was still interesting. And if you travel a lot, if you're interested in traveling a lot, you know, then I think it's worthwhile.
All right. In the news.
Oh wait. By the way, I want to just add another thing. Another similarity. There's actually some heat involved. Because some of these guys, of course, have taken this whole credit card churning thing to the next level. And so, for example, there's a credit card from Wells Fargo that gives you 5% cash back, right?
Uh-huh.
So some of these guys have figured out that you can go to Walmart, buy $1,000 Visa gift cards at like 1% or 0.5%, use those to then go buy money orders, take those money orders and deposit them to pay your credit card bill. And some of these guys, well, there was one guy who was a college student who got shut down by Chase because he had churned $1.2 million doing this in 3 months. And he wanted to know, Chase shut down all his accounts, and he wanted to know if, you know, if he would ever be able to get any Chase cards again in the future. And the guy told him, you will never have another Chase account in your life, and you're lucky that the feds are not knocking at your door.
Okay. Well, that sounds like it's bending the envelope, but doesn't sound like it's a federal crime, but maybe it is.
You know, who knows these days with, you know, they're so paranoid about anything to do with moving large amounts of money that, you know, my favorite quote from my book, Chip Reese said, just because you're not doing anything wrong doesn't mean you won't have to defend yourself someday.
Yes. Yes, I think Billy Walters would say that too. The Facebook, facial recognition, getting into trouble in Illinois about that. Now, this doesn't directly relate to gambling, but there's a lot of APs who would rather that facial recognition disappear and go away. Richard, what do you think this is all about?
Right. So the lawsuit is the people in Illinois have said that using facial recognition software is an invasion of their privacy. So obviously this is a great thing for us. Hopefully, you know, they'll win in Illinois, and then hopefully people will start filing against casinos. You know, for years and years, I've been saying on the radio that facial recognition software in casinos doesn't work. But now I'm hearing that the technology has gotten a lot better and maybe it's starting to work, at least the ones who have, you know, paid to upgrade their systems, I guess. But yeah, if we can find a way to get rid of it, that would be a good thing.
Uh-huh. Dream on. Yeah. All right. In local to Las Vegas news, it was announced today that Station Casinos have purchased the Palms Casino. We'll be looking for a new sponsor. If any of you would like to sponsor Gambling with an Edge, please get in touch. All right, let's talk to Russell Fox. This is not tax news, but it was on your website, taxabletalk.com. A couple days ago, you posted something about full tilt poker remission petitions. What's that all about?
Well, it was announced through the remission processing company, Garden City Group, that approximately 1,500 petitions for remission were denied by the U.S. Department of Justice. Individuals whose petitions were denied were notified by email, and they have 10 days to appeal. If they don't appeal within 10 days, they probably would have to go to court to appeal. And because remission is a voluntary process by the Department of Justice, appealing if your petition was denied is something you should do immediately. If necessary, and you're one of those 1,500 people, you should consult an attorney. This is well beyond my scope of things that I deal with.
And the 10 days expire Monday, May 16. So the clock is ticking. Okay. Let's say I own a house in two different states. States have different taxation levels. What can I do to make the right state my official residence?
Well, for federal purposes, which is not really relevant, the state you spend the most time in during the year is your residence. If there are even more than two states, it's whichever one you spend the most time in. Now, there are exceptions. Everything in tax has exceptions, but generally, the state you spend the most time in is where you reside in for federal purposes. However, for state tax purposes, what is important is a different term called domicile. For 99% of the public, your domicile and residence are one and the same because most people only have one house. And so where that one house is where their domicile is. But states tend to look at a multiple of issues. The general things are, where are you registered to vote? What state do you have a driver's license in or an ID card? Where does your important mail come? Where do you see doctors? If your credit card receipts are examined, where are you spending the most time?
Is it again 6 months?
Or? No. This is where the term domicile really means where you intend to stay. So, for example, let's say you take a three-month assignment in Portland, Oregon, but you have absolutely no intent to stay there. Your residence is still wherever it was, Las Vegas. You just happen to be spending time in Portland.
Okay, but now in my case, I own a home in California, and I own a home here in Las Vegas. Obviously, the very first thing I did was go register to vote, register my car, register my driver's license here in Nevada. So, does that mean, but what if I spend 7 months in California, even though I intend to stay here?
Under California law, you would be a California resident for that year.
Okay.
California law says that if you spend more than six months in a day, in other words, 183 days, in a leap year, 184 days, since this is a leap year, you are a de facto California resident. So one key is you want to never file that first tax return, if at all possible, so you stay off the state's radar. The other thing is if you move, do it the right way. If you're a California resident and you move to Nevada, really move. That will be a great help. And, you know, at minimum, rent a place or do something here to establish a residency for at least 4 months, ideally 6 months. If you spend a week here, you know, reside in an extended stay thing for a week, you haven't moved. You haven't changed your domicile.
Yeah, I mean, I when I moved in the month of November. So that was 2014. So as I say, I immediately changed all those things because I had heard that these were stuff they look at. And California is particularly bad, I guess, about letting you go once they have their hooks in you. So for 2014, I did on my return change my address to Nevada, but I filed as a California resident for 2014.
Well, you could have still probably filed a part year return. If you really move, you can file a part year return regardless. I moved to Nevada December 10th of 2011. I believe that was the date. I filed a part year return. Mind you, I only own one home. I sold my house in Irvine, California, bought a house here in Las Vegas, so it's one house. But and you can file part year returns. And
I didn't know there was such a thing.
There absolutely are, because people move in the middle of a year.
So that means that if I was there 10 months of the year, I would only owe 10/12 of the tax?
Well, you actually, most states look at your tax earned during the period you were a resident, plus source income before or after. In other words, let's assume I move from California to Las Vegas, and I do that in July. I owe California tax clearly before I move, because I was a California resident. After, for the same year, I owe California tax on any California source income I have. If you move from a state which has state income tax to another state that has state income tax, you'll be double taxed on certain items, but you'll be able to take a tax credit for the double taxation on one of the two states' tax returns.
Is this something that if Richard wanted to, he could file an amended return and get some of that back?
Potentially. There's a statute length. For California, it's 4 years from due date or date of filing. The federal statute in most states is 3 years. So possibly. Is it worth it? Maybe, maybe not, because you open yourself up to being, an amended return is looked at by a human. That opens you up to a higher potential of audit. An example of somebody who did this wrong was a basketball referee named Ken Maurer, who you knew who he was.
I know who Ken Maurer is. He missed 5 calls in 13 seconds at a San Antonio, Oklahoma City game a week ago.
Well, he moved.
Not that I hold grudges.
He, quote, moved, unquote, from Minnesota to Florida. Minnesota has a 7% income tax rate. Florida is zero, like Nevada.
Sounds like a smart move.
Sounds like a great move, except he kept spending a lot more time in Minnesota than Florida, and he got audited, and he lost. The state of Minnesota has a 26-factor test that is used to determine residency, and it's subjective. All these are subjective. Each state is a little different in their testing, and if you look on your state's tax website, it will explain this. And it's always a good idea to look what they look at. So if you're going to move, you make sure you check those right boxes and you get all those factors done.
All right, good. Good stuff. Let's move on to a different subject. Let's go over business trips for professional gamblers. You, on the last show, several times, you said, keep good records. If you keep good records, you can handle anything. But to start with, let's assume somebody didn't keep good records.
Well, actually, let me ask this question, because next week I'm going to a funeral or a memorial service in another state, and they happen to have casinos there. Now, the memorial service is only for 1 day, but I'm going to be there for 4 days, and I plan on going to the casino 3 out of the 4 days that I'm there. Can I write off that trip?
You cannot write off your travel to and from the other state, because the primary purpose of the trip is not business. It's the primary purpose that's looked at to determine whether a trip is business or personal. However, you can write off your expenses there for the direct expenses of gambling, since you're a professional gambler. So, for example, let's say you were going to Chicago and you're driving to Hammond, Indiana to go to a casino. You could write off that portion of your rental car or taxi or whatever to get there and back. as far as...
How do they determine what the primary purpose is?
It's subjective. But a typical thing is, why did you make... If in this case, where you're going for a funeral, if there had been no funeral, would you have made the trip?
Well, actually, I would. I would.
You're on the radio. You may want to announce something.
No, I mean, I'm also going because my brother is going to be in town, and he lives out of the country, and I want to go see him, too. But mainly, I'm going to gamble. But I get the point. So, yeah, it has to be that was my primary purpose for going.
But the other question regarding standard amounts, first, anyone's allowed to deduct anything that is both necessary and ordinary. Those mean what you think. They don't have special meaning. If you're in business, any necessary expenses and ordinary expenses have to be both, can be deducted. However, for meals, you're allowed to use what is called the per diem meal allowance. And it is basically a rate published by the General Services Administration, lists every city in the country. For outside of the United States, it's done by the State Department. In Alaska and Hawaii, the Defense Department. For example, last year, 2015, Las Vegas was $71 a day. This year, I think it's $64 a day. And you can use the per diem. However, you must use, if you're going to use the per diem for the entire year. You cannot switch back and forth between actual and per diem during a year.
Isn't there also a per diem for hotel?
There is on the GSA website, but it is not allowed for income tax purposes. Only thing that the per diem is allowed for is meals.
So in other words, I have to keep receipts for the hotel, but not for the meals.
That is correct.
Well, that sucks.
Well, even if you were comped to meals, as long as you use per diem all the time, you can use the per diem for the meals even though they were comped.
You can use the per diem meal deduction for the entire year for business travel. Note, you have to be away from your tax home. So, for example, I take Richard out for lunch for a business meal here in Las Vegas. I can't deduct it because this is in my home metropolitan statistical area. That's considered
my home.
You mean
you can't deduct it by per diem, but you can deduct the meal.
I can deduct it using actual, which means I have to use actual for the entire year.
Oh, wow. So if you have any business meals that you pay for locally, then you have to use that method the entire year.
Yes. However, it may still be that the per diem would give you a higher deduction. One of the things that I find with poker players is they tend to be in two different camps. There's the people on the Subway diet, the $5 footlongs, and then we have people who go to steakhouses every night. Mind you go to a steakhouse every night, you're going to be way above the per diem. Your meals are $5 each, $15 a day. You're going to be way under the per diem. So it could still make sense to use the per diem.
Yeah, those guys who are on the $5 footlong plan, they aren't buying any meals for anybody else.
That's probably true.
All right, good. We have a question from a listener who sent to us, gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. What countries have tax treaties with the United States with respect to gambling winnings? And what advantages are there to being from one of these countries tax-wise?
Well, I looked on IRS publication 515 to make sure I had the complete list, and they are Austria, Belgium, Bulgaria, the Czech Republic, Denmark, Finland, France, Germany, Hungary, Iceland, Ireland, Italy, Japan, Latvia, Lithuania, Luxembourg, Netherlands, Russia, Slovak Republic, Slovenia, South Africa, Spain, Sweden, Tunisia, Turkey, Ukraine, and the United Kingdom. Those countries have a full exemption. Malta, it's taxed at 10%. The benefit is you gamble and normally you would have income tax withheld at 30%. There's no tax withheld.
The problem is the people in the casinos don't know this, and even if you're from one of those countries, I mean, they're going to withhold the money anyway.
Actually, most casinos do know this. Most casinos know the law on this. I know the Caesars properties absolutely do. I'm like 99% certain MGM Mirage knows this quite well. The larger casinos definitely do here in Las Vegas. However, if you're in the middle of Iowa,
I was just going to say, yeah.
They might not know it. The other issue is if you don't already have what is called an individual taxpayer identification number, an ITIN, and the casino is not authorized to issue them, they still must withhold. Some casinos are not authorized. Most in Las Vegas are. In fact, I'm unaware of any in Las Vegas that are not. But if you go in the middle
of... The Lucky Dragon isn't authorized yet.
Okay.
It isn't open, though.
Yeah. But...
Sorry.
But you can still, let's say money is withheld, you can still get it back by filing a Form 1040 NR at the end of the year and applying for an ITIN with the Form 1040 NR.
Okay. In a possibly somewhat related question sent by another listener, how do you treat gambling winnings in foreign countries that have tax treaties about gambling with the United States as a professional? Let's say somebody wins a bunch of money in France, and is that tax the same as if he won domestically?
Yes. Simple answer. Every U.S. tax treaty has what is called a savings clause in it. And it basically, the savings clause means it allows the U.S. to tax its citizens on anything that isn't being taxed by the foreign country. So, for example, if you are in the United Kingdom, which doesn't tax gambling at all, and you win some money at a casino in the United Kingdom, you're going to walk away with whatever you win. But you will owe U.S. income tax if you're a U.S. citizen or permanent resident on that money. The U.S. taxes you on your worldwide income. It doesn't matter if you earn it in Moscow, Idaho, or Moscow, Russia. It's taxed.
All right. 3 months ago on your website, taxabletalk.com, you were discussing the bankruptcy of Caesars Entertainment. You wrote, "For my poker playing readers, it's still unlikely that this bankruptcy will have a direct impact on this year's World Series of Poker. It's in everybody's interest that the WSOP operate as planned because it's profitable. That said, I would not be surprised to find assets such as the WSOP owned by somebody besides Caesars by the end of the year. Has anything happened in the 3 months since you posted that to change your opinion on it?"
No, but a lot has happened. This will take a little bit. In mid-March, a bankruptcy investigator reported that Caesars management deliberately hurt the company through its transactions prior to bankruptcy. From the Wall Street Journal, examiner Richard J. Davis said the principal question he was charged with investigating was whether Caesars and owners Apollo Global Management and TPGLP hurt Caesars Entertainment Operating Company and its creditors by moving CEOC's assets out of its grasp before its bankruptcy filing last year. Quote, "The simple answer to this question is yes," Mr. Davis wrote in his report, which totals more than 1,700 pages. The examiner's findings aren't legally binding, but could be used as a litigation guidepost for creditors unhappy with the asset shuffling. There are numerous lawsuits against Caesars. The total claims could total between $3.6 and $5.1 billion. Second, Mark Rowan of Apollo Global Management resigned from the board of Caesars 3 days after that investigative report came out. You may draw your own conclusions. Third, from Fortune comes word of an extramarital affair of a restructuring advisor working for the bankrupt unit of Caesars Entertainment, and it cost the casino operator a team of key advisors just as the unit faced a deadline to submit its plan to end the bankruptcy. The bankrupt operating unit hired financial advisor Melissa Knoll, K-N-O-L-L, and her team in 2014 to help probe creditor allegations that its parents stripped away its best hotels and left behind a mountain of debt. Caesars denied that, of course. In a little-noticed ruling from the bench in Chicago on March 16th, a judge said that Knoll's team's work was tainted by an affair she had with a lawyer for the parent company of Caesars. Fourth, on Thursday, May 6th, Caesars announced that it hired former federal bankruptcy judge Robert Gerber as, quote, chief restructuring officer, unquote, and warned that it could be forced into bankruptcy. Fifth, on May 2nd, bankruptcy judge Benjamin Goldgar gave Caesars creditors another 2 weeks to agree or disagree with Caesars' restructuring plan. Creditors are waiting for missing details that were supposed to be given to them by April 22nd. Supposedly, that information was released by this past Saturday, May 7th. The next hearing is set for May 25th. My opinion is that all of Caesars will likely be forced into Chapter 11 before the end of the year.
Wow. This sounds like it has the makings of a soap opera. I mean, you could turn this into a television show.
Okay. Well, I, for one, have a low balance of total reward points. Presumably, the casinos would still operate, and seven stars would still be seven stars under the new system, but there's no guarantees.
And please note, this is my opinion. I'm not a bankruptcy attorney. I'm not even an attorney. But the people who have looked at what Caesars did, and I've been in corporate finance, see, it appears, at least on the surface, Caesars deliberately restructured so that there'd be a good Caesars and a bad Caesars, and put the bad Caesars into bankruptcy. If you do that close enough to the time of bankruptcy, that is a violation of bankruptcy law. At least that's what I've been told. It really appears that's what Caesars did.
Is there anything criminal there?
I can't answer that. I speculate on bankruptcy law. I can go to because I've seen enough of it. But I'm not a criminal attorney. But there could be, because when you're on a board of directors, you have a fiduciary responsibility to the shareholders. If not criminal, if you're on a board of directors and you deliberately ignore your fiduciary responsibility, you can be held civilly liable for lots of money. Given we've been talking about amounts and then billions, I know that if I knew about this and I was on the board of directors and I deliberately allowed that to go, I'd be checking my insurance policies.
Wow.
Wow. Okay. New subject. Stanford Wong, in one of his books, I think it was called Blackjack Secrets, he wrote that the difference between a canoe and a card counter is that canoes sometimes tips. Fact remains, tips are cost of doing business for many types of gamblers. For whom are they deductible? And are tips to dealers the same as tips to cocktail servers? Are there limits to what can be deducted?
Again, you can deduct anything that is both ordinary and necessary. Gratuities or tips that are generally accepted, for example, winning a poker tournament or winning a poker hand and tipping, those are generally accepted. They're normal, absolutely deductible. Tipping a cocktail waitress, normal, deductible.
If you're professional, but
you must be, that was the last thing I was going to say.
Okay.
You have to be a professional gambler in order to deduct any business expenses. Amateur gamblers are not allowed to deduct any business expenses.
Yeah, but does anybody really itemize that? I mean, for me, if I go and I sit at a table, right, I buy in, I do a certain amount of playing, I'm going to, pay the tip to the cocktail waitress out of the chips I have on the table, and at the end of the session, I'm going to write down what I won or lost. The tips are all just mixed in there.
Technically, you're supposed to subtract those tips out to get a higher win. The reality, of course, is no one does that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
All right. Let's talk about health savings account, because Richard has a shout-out to give. I receive Medicare, so I don't think I'm eligible for one. Why don't we start with a brief explanation of what a health savings account is and who should consider it?
Well, a health savings account is a high deductible medical plan for either an individual or family. It functions a little like an individual retirement account in that your contributions into an HSA are tax deductible for federal income tax, and most states, but not all, California does not allow it as a deduction, but most states that have state income taxes do. When you put money into your HSA account, you're allowed to use these for qualified medical expenses, seeing a doctor, prescriptions, lab tests, things like that. Most of these plans give you a little credit card to use. Some give you a checking account. These varies by the provider. But they are high deductible plans. So if, for example, your contribution limit last year was about $3,300 for an individual. So if you're going to have, if you happen to have $10,000 of expenses and your deductible is $6,000, you're going to have $3,000 that you have to spend on your own, even after your $3,000 you've contributed.
Yeah, so I've had an HSA for, I don't know, 10 years or whenever they first started. And my only complaint about them was that I was in a, you know, there are only certain places that will open an account for you to hold the money. And all of them that I had investigated and the one I ended up with, they had very limited numbers of mutual funds where you could invest the money and high fees. So now, first of all, I have to say, to me, I think this is like an absolute advantage play for most people because, I mean, first of all, insurance is just gambling, right? And they have a massive edge, the insurance companies. So I've always gone after the highest deductible I can, and this way I can deduct from my taxes whatever my contribution is to the HSA, and the money grows in the HSA tax-free. So no matter how much money I end up with, and then I never take any of it out, because we all know that eventually we're going to have massive medical bills. You know, when eventually when you get old enough, you're going to have, you know, you'll be able to spend the money eventually. At least I think I will. Maybe I'll drop dead, but then, I don't know, my wife will get it or something. But anyway, the good thing that I just found out was there's a company called Saturna. And you,
that's S-A-T...
U-R-N-A.
Okay.
Saturna. And I just transferred my HSA to Saturna, where you have an actual brokerage account. You can buy and sell stocks in addition to mutual funds and ETFs and everything else. And there are no fees as long as you make at least one trade per year. And the cost of the trade is $15. So, yeah. So anybody with an HSA that didn't, that's paying high fees should check out this company, Saturna.
The other nice thing, I actually am a fan of HSAs. I can't recommend or not recommend them. Because of my license, I'm not allowed to. So, but one thing about HSAs are, when you hit Medicare age, you can no longer contribute to an HSA. However, you can still use that money for qualified medical expenses. So you can use it after you're covered under Medicare for your normal...
And when you remove money to pay for those medical expenses, it's not taxed, right?
That's absolutely correct. As long as it's a qualified medical expense.
Right. So it's better than an IRA because, you know, you get to deduct it when you put it in, and you don't get taxed on it when you take it out, as long as you're using it for medical expenses, which, unless something changes drastically in this country with with the way our medical system works, you'll be able to spend it.
I agree.
Yeah.
If, for example, I'm not predicting doom, but if, for example, Richard was hit by a beer truck, and killed instantly, did not have any medical expenses at the end, could that be used for funeral expenses or something like that?
By memory, I'd have to double check this. I do not believe it can be used for funeral expenses, but it does go to a beneficiary.
Yeah, and in my case, I have a family plan, so you know, my wife, et cetera, can, yeah.
All right. Okay, new subject. You filed your tax return early because you expected a refund of $900. And you figured, sooner you file, sooner you get the money back. When it does come back to you, instead of being $900, it is $9,000. There is no explanation note from the IRS. What should you do?
Well, a few years ago, Ohio issued a couple people checks for over $1 million. By mistake. So this actually does happen. I've had clients who have gotten, one client was expecting like $400, got $14,400. Whatever you do, do not spend that money. It's not yours. You should first call the tax agency. Call the IRS up and find out why they sent it to you. It may be, one, it's not completely not yours, and they just sent it to the wrong person. In which case, you know, if you get a check, the IRS has a procedure for returning checks that are erroneous. Second, they may have, may be right. Maybe you made an extra estimated payment, or there was additional tax withheld on a W-2G that you didn't realize. And the IRS will explain to you why they think it's right. If it's still wrong, or you have it direct deposited, you're going to have to write a check back to the IRS so that the IRS gets repaid. A woman in California was expecting her direct deposit, put down her old bank account number by mistake, and it went to somebody else. And we're not talking a dollar here. We're talking $110,000 was her refund amount. Guy got it. Mana from heaven. What can go wrong if I spend it? There's a little thing called theft, and that is grand theft. And he ended up getting 60 days in Orange County, California jail, 18 months probation, and has a felony on his record.
And likely restitution was part of that.
Oh, yes. He absolutely had to make restitution. He did.
Wow. Yeah, I you know, when you get overpaid by a casino, it's one thing, but I'm not going to mess with the federal government.
It's interesting. If I spent it, if I had to make restitution of $110,000, I'm in a position that I could do it. But most people would go manna from heaven and spend it immediately, do not have $110,000 in their back pocket that they...
Well, this guy apparently spent about 60% of it, say $60,000, a little more, but he had enough to make restitution. But it's not your money. I mean, it's, you know, it's one thing, you know, you find a, let's say you find a bag full of money on your front doorstep. There's actually a procedure. You generally turn it into the police. They hold it for 30 or 60 days, depending on the jurisdiction. Nobody claims that it becomes yours. But if, let's say, it dropped out of an armored car, somehow found its way to your front doorstep, it is the armored car's money. And, you know, theft is not a good thing. People go to jail for that.
Well, while he's in jail, he probably earns 60 cents an hour for, that would help him pay back the $110,000. All right. In a fairly recent development, for a relatively small fee, you can pay money you owe the IRS in cash at 7-Eleven stores across the country. Is this a good thing?
I generally think it isn't, because my idea of a 7-Eleven and you going in and cash just to me doesn't make sense, and I question why the IRS did it until I realized that at least for one industry it does make sense. The marijuana industry, big in, for example, Colorado, where it is legalized on the state level. Still under federal law, marijuana is very illegal, and no one in the industry can get a bank account. And they still must make cash payments to both the state and federal government. So the ability, the state of Colorado, by the way, will accept cash at the local, at the Colorado Department of Revenue, but the IRS doesn't. This is a way now to pay your taxes legally. But otherwise, the idea of giving information to a $6 an hour clerk at a 7-Eleven, your personal information, I'm not so enthralled with that idea.
And counting out $50,000 on the counter, making sure it's
that. Yeah, well, 50,000, I mean, these places in Colorado, I can just see a guy going in with suitcases full of money to pay his quarterly, you know, taxes.
I do want to point out this is not every 7-Eleven. You need to look and see. It is only some 7-Elevens that are accepting it. That is my understanding of this. So if you're going to avail yourself of this program, check with your local 7-Eleven first.
Okay.
By the way, they brought up at that frequent traveler university that, you know, because a lot of times when you are trying to churn these credit cards, you need to spend a certain amount of money in the first 3 months or something like that. And so one of the ways you can do that is you can pay your IRS bill with a lot of these credit cards at, I think, a little over 1%, which, you know, for the sign-up bonus on a lot of these cards, it's more than 1%? What is it?
It's the minimum I've seen is 2.5%.
Ah.
It's whatever the credit card discount rate is.
Okay.
And you can look on the IRS website. If you do a search on the IRS website, pay your tax by credit or debit card, you can look at the fees. They are noted.
Yeah. Some of these credit cards, the sign-up bonus is big enough where, it would make sense to do this to churn the amount of money you need to turn over in the first 3 months.
If you have big enough taxes.
Yeah.
All right. Let's talk about backgammon. We don't talk a whole lot about backgammon on this show, but a recent three-day match involving Irishman J.P. McManus and American billionaire Alec Igors ended with McManus $17.4 million ahead. Instead of paying the entire amount, Gores withheld 30%, about $5.2 million, and Gores paid the money to the IRS to cover any tax liability McManus might owe for the match.
In backgammon, we call that a dick move. Really, what an asshole.
As a former backgammon player, although I never played for anywhere near those stakes, I found this surprising. I could not have phrased it better than Richard did. A significant percentage of backgammon gambling results are never reported to the IRS in the first place. Surprise, surprise. McManus found this so outrageous that he's suing the IRS to get the money back. Russell Fox, what do you think his chances are?
They're pretty good, and actually, it might be that the money had to have been withheld. If you have gambling winnings and a person doesn't supply a Social Security number or an ITIN, and it's possible Mr. McManus didn't have an ITIN, Mr. Gores had to withhold. That's the law.
As an individual.
Yeah, I mean, if as an individual, you have to obey the law. And if you pay someone, for example, this is a very common thing. A lot of poker players are backed. They have, you know, they enter a tournament for $10,000 and they sell action. So it reduces their variance. And, for example, Canadians, if they go into a casino in the U.S., have 30% of their winnings withheld. Canadians have the ability to get some back, but withholding is mandatory. So American poker players who are backed by Canadians have to withhold 30%, period, because that's what the law says.
Why would any Canadian back, if that's the case, why would any Canadian back a player?
I will only tell you, it's common. Wow. I'm not going to go into the whys, but getting back to this, though, there's a couple interesting possibilities here. First, I suspect Mr. McManus didn't have an ITIN. That's why the withholding was done, and it would have been correct to, and I would have advised Mr. Gores to withhold. Then the question is, did Mr. McManus file a Form 1040 NR within the statutory period? He had 3 years from the due date of that return. I think this happened in 2012. I read the article. I think that's what it said, meaning he would have had to have filed a tax return by 2016, by April 18th. If he did, money should have been, the U.S. and Ireland have a tax treaty exempting gambling. Remember we talked about those tax treaties earlier in the show? Ireland is one of those countries. So he may owe Irish tax on this, but he shouldn't owe U.S. tax.
Yeah, I don't think Ireland has any taxes on gambling winnings.
I think they do. I do think they have taxes on gambling winnings. The U.K. doesn't. I think Ireland does. It's not large, but I believe they do. They used to, at least.
Huh.
Okay.
I had a friend who was considering getting Irish citizenship back 15 years ago or so, because at that time they did not. So maybe things have changed.
Okay. But the IRS could have argued that this isn't gambling. It's a skill contest. Now, skill contests are still taxed under their not gambling, but their other income. However, the U.S.-Ireland tax treaty exempts other income, not gambling. So in any case, I think withholding might have been required, but he should have been able to get his money back. And Mr. McManus definitely has the money to fight the IRS in court, and I suspect he'll get paid.
Yeah, I suspect, too. I mean, if I were him, I would certainly want to give all the bad press I could to the guy that withheld the money. So that was probably more what this article was about than the, you know, than the actual collection.
Well, I don't know. If the guy he was beating was a bad enough if you win $17.2 million, you probably think you're better than the other guy. You probably don't think, well, I just got lucky. He's just as good as me. So if you have a pigeon who's willing to play you for high stakes, you want to make that pigeon happy. You don't want to embarrass him, do you?
Yeah, no, that's reasonable.
I mean, if I agreed to play you backgammon, wouldn't you be really nice to me?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Actually, that always baffled me. You know, the good players that berate. This happens in poker all the time, too. That
Phil Hellmuth is a good example of this.
That berate the bad players. It's crazy.
All right. Last time you were on the air on our show, Russell Fox, you suggested using the email address rcfox@claytontax.com. Is that still the best way to get in touch with you?
It still is.
All right. Or if they can remember their taxabletalk.com, there's a button to click there for contact Russell.
Same email address.
All right. We've got some more questions for listeners. And I got a feeling after this show we'll get even more, and so it's mandatory that you come on again. What's the proper way to file your taxes and log sheet if you were on a joint bankroll, such as a team, and you hit some W-2Gs? As an example, I hit for 8,000 in W-2Gs. My net score on the session was plus $6,000. The team has a net result of $20,000 for that day. After it's all chopped up, I walk away with $5,000. Do I record an $8,000 W-2G on taxes and a $3,000 gambling loss that nets to the $5,000? Is that the way to do it?
No, it's not, because you didn't have a gambling loss. You netted $6,000, but it's not your money. It goes to the team. You need to issue the team a 1099 miscellaneous to transfer the income from yourself to the team. The team will then in turn issue you, assuming you're part of the team. The team is a partnership. Partnership doesn't necessarily have to be formal. We can have an informal handshake partnership, although I do recommend you formalize it if at all possible so you avoid disputes. The team will then issue what are called Schedule K-1s to all its partners. And that's how the income goes back to you. It can be ridiculous at times where you have, say, $8,000 of income going to the team, and you get a K-1 back for $8,000. So it goes in, out, and back in for the exact same dollar amount. But technically, that is the way it's supposed to be.
But now, you only have to do that once at the end of the year, right? You don't have to do that every...
Yeah, you send one 1099 per person or partnership per type of income per year. So, you know, it's possible, for example, you might send the same person a 1099 for interest income and a 1099 for gambling income. It's theoretically possible. And you might send, you know, someone for dividends and gambling income. They would go on two different 1099s, but it's one per person per year.
So, I mean, boy, it seems like this would be really easy to get screwed up. But so let's say that you have $120,000 in W-2Gs. Your personal wins and losses don't really matter if everything is part of the team, right? I mean, so do you just 1099 the team for $120,000, and then you get whatever your share is, you get K-1'd back, whatever you earned?
Basically, yes. That's exactly what's supposed to happen. I'll give an example. I do the tax returns for a number of gambling syndicates. And, for example, in horse racing, there's a syndicate I do in Florida. They gamble on horses. Horse racing has taxes withheld. The individual who runs it gambles, and he can easily get 10 W-2Gs, not 1099s, but he gets W-2Gs for $300,000-$400,000. That all goes to the partnership that he runs, and then it comes right back his share. Now, mind you, since he's the one placing the bets, and there are multiple partners, he is not getting back, say, $300,000. But the IRS inquired about it the first year he did it to make sure we were doing it right. They held up his refund because the taxes withheld on the $300,000. There's withholding in horse racing at a fairly low level of income.
Yep.
And so, you know, but the IRS blessed it completely. It's exactly the right way of doing it.
What if I What if I'm a backer on the team? I put up some of the bankroll. I never set foot in the casino. It's still the same process.
Yeah, you get a K-1. That'll show gambling income. Now, the gambling income, if it's done right, is considered and will be noted as other income. And you then have to, most tax software, you'll have to manually put it where it belongs. So you have, it literally can be technically gambling income on your return going out and going right back in.
In your last appearance on the show, you read part of a tax court judgment for a video poker player that said the court didn't believe that players playing a machine in a casino could be considered professional gamblers because, after all, the casino sets up the games to profit the casinos. Anybody who actually wins is just plain lucky. Now that bothered me. Not surprisingly to our listeners, I think being a successful video poker professional is very possible. I win most years and pay taxes. I haven't been audited recently, knock on wood. If I am, and the IRS uses this ruling to declare that it's impossible for me to actually be a professional gambler because I play machines, how would I go about fighting that?
Well, let's say this happened to me. I would probably get somebody like Bob Dancer as an expert witness.
I like the sound of this.
And literally, the people who have tried this haven't really looked at this and gotten, you know, they've basically cited books and not had the people who've written those books testifying. And if I were, I'm not an advantage gambler. I actually sort of am. If I'm going to play video poker, I do it the right way. I do try to be an advantage player, but it's not how I make my living. I make my living preparing tax returns and representing taxpayers. What I would advise is you hire people who are experts. Means like a Bob Dancer as an expert witness. The IRS is not going to find somebody when a casino sets a pay table at, say, 100.3%. That's going to argue that it's less than one, you know, less than 100%. They can't argue that because it's wrong, and the IRS would realize it. Most likely your case would be settled, and it wouldn't go to court. The IRS appeals looks at the possibility of it being lost, and while in Las Vegas, appeals officers are actually fairly good and understand gambling. If you were in, say, Ottumwa, Iowa, you have more of a chance of this kind of case going to trial because the appeals officers there probably have less experience with gambling.
You've mentioned Iowa twice this hour as being part of Podunkville, United States. Do you have a...
You'll get hate mail.
I don't know. Do rcfox@claytontax.com. All right, good. We've been talking to Russell Fox. We're going to have him on again. So send us your tax questions. We will get as many of them as you can. The information he gave us today was gold. South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. This is more than anybody else has. The big promotion in May is $500,000 swipe, spin, and win. You play $300 coin in on video poker Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and spin the virtual wheel. Low-end prizes are 2,500 points worth $7.50. Mystery gifts, well, you know what casino gifts are. And lunch buffets. Highest gifts are $25 and $50 of free play. For the first, there's been 5 days of the promotion so far, and so I've done it 10 times, including Bonnie and me, averaging approximately $25 of cash, where I'm assuming free play is cash and the points. You can win 2,500 points or 5,000 points. That's worth $15. So the average is more than $25 cash per day for $300 coin in. If you live close to the area, it's a very nice low roller play. And it was actually good on... no, it wasn't. That was something else. The next double point days is Memorial Day, Monday, May 30th. This swipe, spin, and win will be on that day. midnight to midnight, no limits. For those so inclined, penny slots earn 10 times points that day, and other reels earn 5 times points that day. They have free senior slot tournaments on Thursdays, where more than $5,000 in free play is given away each week. At the Palms, they have drawings every Saturday night at 7:15. Must be present. You do not need to be present to win. You do need to collect before midnight. Players who win and claim share $10,000. PFP play for prizes on it's Monday through Friday. From now until this Friday, May 13th, you earn Chevron gift cards. Cards are earned and redeemed at a rate of 0.2% up to $190 per day. You keep your points. From May 16th to 27th, you earn gift cards to Costco. Every Sunday in May, you earn double points on video poker and 10 times points on reels and video reels. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get corrections on most of the game. Game of the week is split card draw poker. This is a 10 coins per line game where periodically you receive a split card on either the deal or the draw. Let's say the computer randomly picks the 8 of clubs as the basis of the split card. One third of the time, you get a 9 of clubs with it. One third of the time, 7 of clubs. And one third of the times you get a duplicate 8 of clubs. So then you will have 6 card hands to pick the best 5 of. All right. We've been talking to Russell Fox. On our next week's show, we are going to have two poker players talking about the upcoming World Series of Poker, which starts on May 31st of this month. The following week, we talk to a legendary blackjack player and investment guy, Blair Hall. All right, Richard, how do people get in touch with us?
Well, first of all, we welcome your questions. Send them to us at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com or post them on facebook.com/gamblingwithanedge, or you can tweet them at us at RWM21. To get the show delivered to you automatically every week, you can sign up for that at iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, or my site, richardmunchkin.com. And to find an archive of every episode ever recorded, you can find that at bobdancer.com.
And we want to thank again Russell Fox for tax advice. And you can count on us calling on you again. Thank you, Russ. Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.